Thank you for listening to this podcast from KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. We invite you to listen to more music and talk on our grassroots nonprofit radio station in Laguna Beach, California, from anywhere in the world on KX93.5.com/listen or on our smartphone apps. But right now, here's that podcast from KX93.5.
KXRN LP Laguna Niguel, Laguna Beach. Member supported KX93.5.
This disclaimer is a statement notifying listening audiences that any opinions expressed on our shows are not representative of Laguna Radio Inc., its management, or its board of directors.
And good evening, Laguna Beach, and welcome to the Dr. Kim Sage Show. My name is Kim Sage. I'm a clinical psychologist, and this show airs live Monday evenings at 8 p.m. on KX93.5, your local independent radio. And really, on our show, we just explore topics related to mental health and therapy and psychology with a goal in helping you really just live your best life. And so tonight we have a wonderful topic and another wonderful guest I'm super excited to welcome. We are going to be talking, really the question tonight is going to be, do you need intensive mental health treatment? And really, what is that? And how do we differentiate, let's say, weekly therapy from going into some kind of a program? We have a guest tonight who is the executive director for the Lido Wellness Center, Dr. Leslie Tate Gould. Welcome, Dr. Gould. We are just going to dive into some topics. Will you please share a little bit with us about your role at Lido Wellness Center and what you do there?
Yes, thank you. So my role at Lido Wellness is, as you said, I'm the executive director. So that encompasses a lot of different roles, right? So we are a clinician-owned facility. So that means that myself and my program director, Francis Milligan, we are kind of the eyes and ears of what's happening clinically within all aspects of our program. So as the executive director, that can be things like part of, you know, the hiring and organizational part of things, but also most certainly being on the clinical side of things. So even though I'm the director, I'm kind of like right on the front end. So I'm doing individual, family, couples, group psychotherapy every single week. I have a lot of correspondence with both the clinical team, the executive team, and then also, of course, with the patient care.
Great. Okay, thank you. And so what we're talking about is where you work is really a place people go for more intensive treatment, right?
Right.
So this is different than, let's say, weekly therapy or twice weekly therapy. Let's just get into what I really want to talk about is how do we differentiate? You know, let's say I come to you and I'm having some struggles. Where do I begin to draw the line? I mean, we'll get to the really obvious ones, but let's talk about the subtle signs first, like a collection of symptoms or difficulties perhaps that might make me a good candidate for receiving an outpatient mental treatment program.
Right. So really good question, because some of those different things are very subtle, right? It's often when things are kind of blaring people in the face that it makes it very easy to make that distinguishment. You know, we specialize in mood disturbances, so that can be on that framework of bipolar presentations, unipolar depression, generalized anxiety presentations, and kind of how some of those can really come together, coalesce, is also just from that foundation of, is there kind of an undercurrent of some type of psychological stressor and or trauma, or a combination of trauma, right? So chronic, excessive, you know, kind of prolonged traumas that somebody's encountered in their day-to-day living. And I can certainly in a different framework, you know, even talk about kind of what trauma is, what trauma is, and that might be for a different talk and conversation. But, you know, some of the ways in which, you know, we see some of these subtle differences is that we look at kind of level of impairment. So if somebody is, you know, going through what's called like a situational stressor, so if they're having a big transition at home, right, if they're going through a divorce or if there's been a major loss, it would be totally appropriate and understandable for them to have some feelings, some loss of functionality, some real difficulty of meeting some of their day-to-day obligations, right? So if they're a parent, you know, maybe needing to take time away, you know, from managing all the daily functions of their children, or if they're working, maybe taking some time away from work. Where we kind of look at things as far as that understanding of impairment of functional, you know, productivity in life is how, what's the time constraint, right? Are these things situational in which, you know, people are having an understandable and what, I mean, I hate to use the word appropriate, right? But an appropriate response to some type of stressor, or is it prolonged? You know, was the stressor 8 months ago? And, you know, some of that impairment is still lingering, right? Are they still not able to get to their day-to-day functions, right? We use a term called activities of daily living, or ADLs. And so those are things like hygiene. You know, is their hygiene starting to slip or become compromised? And hygiene can look as simple as getting up and showering, or as complex as, you know, doing some of their basic care, but also being able to prepare meals for themselves or others. Being able to keep a tidy home, or something that, you know, feels livable and safe and harmonious with what their objectives have been, you know, thus far in their life. You know, so we're kind of looking at things from a lot of different angles. You know, there's Maslow, you know, kind of talks about like a hierarchy of needs, right? So we're looking at things like, you know, kind of from that foundational place, like are their eating needs being met? Are their sleeping needs being met? And then it's further, you know, in that examination, are their relational needs being met? You know, so we're kind of looking in a lot of different areas when we're assessing on whether somebody needs a type of care like ours. And we're also looking at what have they tried in the past? You know, are they connected, and have they found a lot of deep meaning and connection from like maybe a spiritual practice? And has that then gone by the wayside? You know, are they still able to access some of those components in their life that they have normally found supportive, but then, you know, based on a series of factors or transitions, are they not able to, you know, adhere to some of those supportive environments in the way that they used to.
Okay. Okay. So what you're saying also is that obviously we go through life events that are difficult. We have certain periods and peaks and valleys, right? We go through them, and it's I want to say normal, but it is, right? You lose a loved one, you go through a divorce, you have a health issue, let's say you go through breast cancer. Like this, there are some major life events that can certainly exacerbate underlying conditions that can then unfold and not be worked through. I think so. We're talking about, yes, we have difficult events, but when we're looking at why we would go to an intensive outpatient program, we're saying, okay, this sort of like ripple effect is affecting more than just one thing, right? It's affecting your functioning, your daily living, your activities, your well-being. It is sort of this beginning hallmark. You don't have to be like, you know, completely out of control. I think that's what I really wanted people to get, is that there are variations, there's a spectrum of difficulties, I think, that make people appropriate for intensive treatment. So I think that's a really good point, right? It varies, but it tends to encompass more than just one typical life event or one experience. Maybe it's one event, but it's now kicked off a bunch of other underlying issues you have.
Right. I mean, and that's a really important point, because when you're working from the framework of trauma, for instance, you know, trauma is something that I would say that most civilized individuals, most people that are, you know, able to, you know, be upright and working and functional have encountered some form of trauma. And what we know about trauma also is that it has less to do with the event itself and far more to do of what its impact has been on a person's nervous system, right? And so with that said, you know, what I often see, you know, coming into our doors, say at Lido Wellness, or even that matter, you know, in my private practice, is that there might be something that's, you know, conscious, right, that this person is conscious of that isn't going well, right? Like, so it might be a relationship is falling apart at work, or you know, there's a situational stressor happening with somebody's child, you know, they keep getting called into the principal's office. And then all of a sudden, through a series of conversations and or, you know, kind of a reexamination of what's happening in their body, we start to see kind of these patterns, right? We start to see things emerging that, you know, there wasn't even consciousness of. And then through, you know, talk psychotherapy and then some of the approaches that I use, because I'm a somatic experiencing practitioner, which means, you know, a different type of, you know, advanced certification where you're really looking at how these things are actually held in and are being kind of manifested in the body. When you're looking from those angles at things, all of a sudden that which seemed maybe, you know, something very common, you know, like a divorce or some type of stressor, all of a sudden is kind of, you know, having this reverberated ripple effect of, wait, there's actually more times in my life, for instance, that I have been compelled to say yes when really I've wanted to say no, right? Or that I've gone along with things, but I've had this kind of instinctual gut response that has actually wanted me to do something different. And how that can then, you know, show up in the room is that there can be symptoms, right? There can be kind of this symptomatology that, you know, really begs people, both as the consumer end of things, but most certainly as psychotherapists, to be paying attention, to be mm-hmm. asking different questions.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that people that come to your programs, especially we're talking not about necessarily addiction, but mental health issues specifically, have they already been in traditional therapy before? And if so, what has been the experience and how often?
You know, it really varies. I would say that we have one population or percent of our population that this is not a new experience, right? That they've maybe been through hospitalizations or they've been through a residential stay in a treatment program, which is much more intensive, right? So that's 24-hour care. Usually, you know, they're in locations that are very beautiful, you know, that there's a lot of kind of nourishing, supportive environmental, you know, supports that make great offerings, right, to somebody who's going through something really distressing or challenging. And then, you know, in so again, so there's a small percentage that, you know, has that type of experience. But then we've also had a percentage of our population that maybe they've, you know, only gone to therapy here and there, and maybe it was not really their idea, right? So mm-hmm. it might have been, oh, well, I went to therapy when I was a kid because my parents got divorced, but I went to 5 sessions and I hated it the whole time, and now I've never looked back, and here I am.
Right, right. Okay.
So I'd say
it can vary.
Yeah, right. It really
okay.
does vary.
Okay, good. So I'm going to just list some of the signs that I sort of researched. I want you to just talk about them a little bit, if you wouldn't mind. Then we're going to go into a little more clinical discussion of major depressive disorder, anxiety, things like that. But a lot of the signs I think that I've researched and that I see is things like replaying a traumatic event in their head, not being able to move through, let's say, a trauma, like you mentioned. Obviously, these are going to also fall under the criteria of depression and anxiety or other disorders, but withdrawing from others, disconnected, feeling alone, not really, you know, or maybe isolating, finding yourself not wanting to engage, substance abuse, clearly. Maybe your family and friends are worried about you. Maybe you think you're fine, but you keep hearing that you're not so fine. Things like your productivity at work or your lack of enjoyment for things. Mm-hmm. And then obviously physical aches and illness, sleep, appetite, you know, sort of your basic, like we were saying, signs of wellness are basically off. Obviously things like panic attacks or dark thoughts, but those earlier signs where it's like begins to collect together. Let's say the one where your family and friends are concerned, but you think you're fine. How often do you see something like that?
Oh gosh. You know, by the time people arrive in front of me, it is kind of with this joined effort from family members who are coming together and saying, hey, you know, I think these things are happening. So often by the time someone comes into a program like ours, those conversations have already happened. Mm-hmm. But it is a challenge in so much as what I do see from time to time is somebody say might come in with the idea that, okay, the area in my life that I'm struggling really profoundly is anxiety. Right. And so that's kind of maybe the key symptomatology that seems to present itself. So it might be sleeplessness, being on edge, difficulty following through with activities because there's so much worry that they're going to do it wrong or they're going to be perceived as doing it poorly. And so they just don't engage. But then, you know, especially in Lido Wellness, because for instance, if somebody starts with our 6-hour a day program, that's a lot of time, right, around clinicians, also amongst treatment peers. And so often we get a little bit more, right? We get kind of a little bit deeper into what actually might be the foundation, what might be driving some of that presentation that's happening consciously, which is the restlessness, the keyed up, you know, the difficulty with worry and follow through. Mm-hmm. And so we also really understand and prioritize the importance of involving family systems, so involving family members, whether that's a partner, a child, if it's meaningful and indicated, or most certainly we see a lot of young adults that we treat, and so involving their parents, because we also know that these are key players that know this person really well. Sometimes if there has been kind of that more with the presentation of depression, that difficulty being able to perceive and understand the world, like kind of in so much as like having like a realistic appraisal of behaviors, family members are key in just being able to provide collateral information, but also to provide education on what this is and what it isn't.
Right.
You know, because I've sometimes with good intentions, of course, I've had parents say, well, gosh, like if they could only just be not be lazy, right? Or if they could just, you know, get their act together and then, you know, they would just see that they would feel so much better. Mm-hmm. But when you are dealing with something as pervasive as major depression, that's not a helpful stance, right? That can actually unintentionally, of course, be really damaging.
Absolutely.
So you know, it's how do you involve those parties and just kind of start to shift some of that energy from what isn't working to what is working, right? Where are their resources at?
Yeah, I think that's really important. I think what's happening when they get to you, they've already been confronted by family, what you're saying, right?
Right.
But I do think that many people, the family keeps saying like something's wrong, you're not doing well. And oftentimes there's denial, I think, especially with depression, because you are in that place where you don't necessarily see it. And I do know that, you know, mental health issues take such a toll on family members as well.
Absolutely.
It truly is. It's like the ripple that goes across the entire lake. And so it's so great when programs, I think, involve family, because relationships, I think, are the core of our well-being. And even if it's not a healthy family system and you need to work to separate from that, sometimes that's the issue, right? But at the end of the day, it does affect everybody within the perimeter of a person who's struggling.
Yeah, I mean, I saw this so much when I used to work in primary substance abuse, but now I see it, of course, for different reasons. But when you're dealing with complex trauma, in that family members at times just feel so stagnant on what to do and how to help.
Mm-hmm.
And like you mentioned, you know, or at times if they might be perpetrating, right, and contributing to some of that presentation and not even know it. Or if then the patient or the identified patient, if you will,
mm-hmm.
If they might not even know
right.
that what they're being exposed to.
So normal.
It's so normal and it's so familiar. And and for a lot of them, unfortunately, and I, when I say them, I don't mean like every person that comes into our office, but for a lot of people in general, right, that if these are your, you know, family members and this is kind of all you've known, it's also such a risk. Right. Of considering that, gosh, like if I have to confront this person that I've only got one mom in the whole world.
Right.
And, you know, if I've got to confront them and, you know, ask something to be different in this relationship, does that mean then that the relationship can even be salvaged?
Right.
Really scary stuff. Right. So, you know, we work really hard. My team and I, you know, we work really hard to not only provide a lot of education, that's such an essential component of any psychotherapy, whether you're in a treatment program or if you're with an outpatient therapist. But we also just like to provide just a lot of support around, you know, the premise that, you know, people are often doing the very best that they can with the limited skills and tools that they have.
Right.
And so even if they're showing up in a greatly, you know, undermined or limited way, that doesn't mean that they're a bad person, right? But that it means that, gosh, like maybe you need to cultivate something else in your life,
right?
So that you're not continuing to go to that person who's got some limitations for the needs that you have that are very real and valid.
Right. That's a good point. So we were talking about sort of the lighter collection of symptoms. What degree of mental health in terms of the more severe end of things do you guys tend to work with and serve, and how does that tend to present itself?
Yeah, because we are a partial hospitalization and intensive outpatient program. And so what that means and why hospital is in the name of our program is that we deal with very high acute mental health presentations. So, and by high acute, I mean just kind of level of severity. So, you know, we can handle and we can manage someone who might be both with, you know, at times active or just holding a lot of time, maybe some passive suicidal ideation, right? Where they might have ruminating thoughts and wishes of wanting to die, but that, you know, maybe they're able to demonstrate for a period of time that they will be safe and that they're not going to act on those intentions. So with that level of acuity, we want to make sure that we also have a lot of medical support on our team and on our side and for that patient, right? So when you're looking at something like partial hospitalization and that level of acuity, you're looking at traditional psychotherapy. So looking at things like talk psychotherapy, group psychotherapy, individual, that kind of thing. But then you're also looking at psychiatry because psychiatry at this level of acuity is very, very important.
Absolutely.
And so we're really fortunate that we've got a great medical director. We have a fabulous psychiatric nurse practitioner and a psychiatric nurse whom all oversee every one of our patients that comes in. So we do that very intentionally because there are a lot of kind of co-occurring variables when you're dealing with this level of acuity. For instance, sometimes medical presentations, whether it's diabetes or hypertension or, you know, some of these other kind of medical ailments can at times present as though they are mental health diagnoses, right? And so we really want to make sure that we rule out and that we ensure that anybody coming into a program like ours is also medically sound and stable to be able to participate to their fullest extent, right? Because we would hate to have someone come and then based on, you know, some medical complications that are otherwise out of their control or awareness, compromise their ability to engage in a program like ours.
That makes sense. So if you're just tuning in, I'm talking with Dr. Leslie Tate Gould. She is the executive director at Lido Wellness Center. And we're talking about really the idea of what is intensive mental health treatment and how do you know if you need it? What happens when you go? And Dr. Tate Gould was just explaining partial hospitalization and what that means. And so can you describe for us how many hours per day, how many days per week? So the average listener probably has no idea. And like you said, the word hospital in there, you know, it can be a little confusing, I think. So can you explain that for us?
Sure. So partial hospitalization, like I was saying, for those just joining, basically why we've got the hospital name in there. And a lot of times we're kind of at the mercy of managed care, right? And just kind of what they dictate and prescribe as levels of care. So there's a few different levels. So partial hospitalization is a 6-hour program each day, Monday through Friday. Okay. And so our program runs Monday through Friday from the hours of 9 in the morning until 3 p.m. And we also do a supported lunch. And so that way, you know, when patients are there, they can really just hunker down and you know, be a part of the community and the treatment milieu. And, you know, we provide the lunch. And so they're going to be doing a thing or a series of different group psychotherapy. And then they'll be taken out to do individual sessions. They'll have their psychiatry appointments. They'll also at times, you know, have their family sessions. So I'll take you through kind of what a typical day would look like, right?
Great.
If somebody were to, you know, be arriving upon admission for a partial program with us. So the 9 o'clock hour is kind of our check-in group. So as you can imagine, you know, when people are participating with this level of acuity with their mental health symptomatology, a lot can happen from the hours of 3 p.m. until 9 o'clock the next morning.
Right. Or the weekends. I want to talk about that too.
For yeah, sure.
Keep going.
And so we really set a lot of intention, my program director and I, and, you know, just a lot of our psychotherapeutic staff, we set a lot of intention around how we structure our day. So the 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock hour is to just check in. Let's see what worked last night, what didn't. I do check in on Thursday mornings. And so I like to, you know, find out, you know, what was happening, what was working, what was successful, what wasn't. We also have a series of assignments that every patient coming in is assigned to. So we might have some time to, you know, work on some assignments, which just give us a little bit more of an in-depth examination of maybe family patterns or behaviors or, you know, looking at a timeline. So especially when you're looking at things like trauma, you want to know, like, what were some of those key variables? What were some of those key instances that might be contributing to present day level functioning and or not functioning? And then from 10 to 12:30, we do kind of our breakout session of the morning. So that's going to be led by a licensed clinician who might specialize. And in fact, a lot of our clinicians have kind of some enhanced certification. So we might be doing things like, you know, on my group on Wednesdays, since I'm a somatic experiencing practitioner, we dedicate an entire morning time to learning more about somatic experiencing and basically knowing what's going on in our bodies and building kind of a greater tolerance and awareness of what's happening in our bodies. We might do that through traditional talk, you know, forms, but most certainly in my groups, we're going to be doing a lot of movement. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be getting up out of our chairs. We're going to be using our, you know, we've got a big space. We use the space to really kind of understand what are the bounds and boundaries of our bodies. And to get just better acquainted and familiar with them. Mm-hmm. And then we break for lunch. And then the afternoon, again, with intention, because the morning can at times, after a few hours, be very, very heavy. We have a lot of different experientials. So by experiential meaning, they still have a therapeutic component, but that they're not going to be kind of viewed in that traditional sense of sitting down and talking. So like on Mondays, we have an in-clinic kind of recreational activity. So that might be like a spiritual practice or a guided meditation that then they can, you know, use some like supported artwork or, you know, different type of modalities to kind of just have a little bit more of an inquiry about what's happening, but not in that kind of more traditional sense. We have a trauma-informed yoga practice. So on Thursdays, you know, the afternoon, they do a yoga practice that is led by a certified instructor. Fridays, we do a recreational outing. So they might go, you know, and do paddle boarding, or they might go build sandcastles and do frisbee golf, or, you know, like do different things. That also has kind of that component of community building that has some support around just social interactions because, you know, as we know, right, we're getting into a day and age in which social interactions, just making eye contact with another person and just having chit chat is a lot harder for folks, mm-hmm. Especially if they've been compromised, you know, by trauma, major depression, generalized anxiety, you know, having that practice and like going about it in a way that's also fun and inviting and invigorating is really beneficial. And so, like I said, so 9 to 3, you know, that's our partial program. And we, again, we kind of have different breakout series to, you know, do kind of the psychoeducation, the process orientation of things, but then also in the afternoon, do a little bit more of kind of the light experiential and getting into their bodies, you know, sides of things.
Awesome. That sounds amazing. Yeah. So you're doing all this wonderful work Monday through Friday, as you talked about. 3 o'clock, you go home. A lot can happen between 3 p.m. and 9 a.m. Yeah. But what about the weekends? How do you talk to the people in your program about what that can look like and what's the process there?
Yeah, you know, since we've been opened, we've really had to kind of reexamine some different strategies around weekend planning, right? Because weekends are times in which, you know, for some of our patients, they might go home, right? Like they might, if they're living nearby or, you know, or if the relatives are close by, they might be spending a lot of time with those, you know, members of their family. And if that family system is one that's, you know, again, unintentionally been contributing to some of the diagnostic presentation, we like to give a lot of support, you know, around let's role play, let's navigate what that could look like. I often will have a lot of conversation with the patients that I treat about what topics are okay to explore with unstructured supervision, mm-hmm. and then what topics are not such a good idea to explore, you know, so unpacking, you know, the way in which, you know, your mom severely let you down at your high school graduation, not a good idea, you know, to do second week over the weekend.
Right, right.
But, you know, in keeping things light and being able to start practicing with people, you know, what are things that you can really explore, you know, if you are going to have support from family? We like to look at, you know, what are some behaviors, what are some coping strategies that, oh gosh, like if life throws you, you know, something challenging over the weekend, who can you call? You know, who are some of your go-to
resources.
People?
Yeah.
What are your resources?
Yeah.
So we even on Fridays, we kind of break up our morning agenda and we do a whole hour dedicated just solely to weekend planning.
Right.
So we're really looking at, you know, what are some of those key strategies that can set them up for success? And then also letting people know, hey, you're human. It's not going to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And so what are you going to do should something not go the way that you want it?
Great.
Right.
So you're preparing them and sort of, you know, front loading what to expect, how to plan in a way that's likely to be successful. I think that's super, super important. I was just thinking to myself, it's so funny how patients will sometimes get really into therapy and you're talking about the family dynamics, and then they, well, Dr. Sage said that you shouldn't be, you know what I mean? And it's like, I can just see that in this program, you're doing all this intensive work, and the last thing you want them to do, oftentimes they get super excited about the fact they're learning things about themselves, right? And they're, but it's like, that's not always the place you want to go in alone to on that weekend off, because that can be actually very catastrophic to staying sober, to managing your symptoms. And so how do the family dynamics and those, we're talking unhealthy situations, I'm sure that happens. And I do think it's important to remind them, hey, you are human if it does. But I think they need tools and skills to, even when they do begin to want to do that work, because it can be too much, especially for family members who aren't in the room doing the work with you.
That's a really good point. And you know, I'm often quick to remind the patients that are in a program like ours to, whenever possible, right? When, as long as there's not something blatantly undermining or abusive happening, you know, on the heels of a family member, to really meet them with a lot of grace and gentleness, because you're right. I mean, I even kind of have like a little chart that I, you know, depict this with patients, in that, you know, they're in such intensive work and are, you know, kind of constantly, you know, in this examination process of challenging their thoughts, of, you know, getting support from a clinician. You know, we have a very open door policy. And so, you know, all of our, you know, patients, you know, refer to us by first name. You know, we are, you know, we will sit down at times if we can get stolen away from a session or two, mm-hmm. or a staff meeting, you know, to have lunch with them. Like it's a very casual, very warm experience. And so we really invite them to, also, you know, at times be able to really meet their parents or their family members with that same type of transparency, right? But also to do it in such a way that's, hey, you're really doing this and you're in a very intensive program, and they might not have that same support, but that doesn't mean they're not willing to, right. But they're just kind of in a different path. Mm-hmm. I also use, you know, the fact that, especially for some of my younger folks, they haven't had 20 or 30 plus years of, you know, kind of a repetitive pattern of doing things yet. Mm-hmm. And so to also kind of give parents, you know, I say parents a lot because that tends to be kind of our primary population, right? We'll be dealing with young adults and then working with their parents, you know, giving them the benefit of the doubt.
Right.
Right. And while I say that, also knowing that there are important things that are crucial for, you know, parents and loved ones to really begin to question and to challenge and to really start to consider that there can be a different way in which they can also engage.
Right.
Because I can only imagine, you know, I'm a parent myself, but as I was sharing with you, you know, my kids are little, but there's ways in which, you know, even as a psychotherapist, right, like I have to be open and willing to look at some of the family of origin, the stuff that I'm bringing into that realm as a new parent myself, and ways in which if I'm getting feedback about something that's meaningful and it's coming from a dear place and also somebody who has a know, you know, how of how to do things, I want to be taking that in. I want to be, you know, kind of examining how can I really use this to my advantage or what can I leave, right? Like what doesn't fit or what doesn't feel, you know, meaningful at this time. Mm-hmm. So I think for a lot of folks, especially with this level of acuity, it's a lot of psychoeducation. You know, right. I like to resource, you know, family members as much as possible with books, recommendations, meetings, you know, ways in which they can also do some resourcing and some of their own growth and support before they're coming into the room and participating.
So important. It is, because I think so many parents have so much guilt and fear that they're going to be told that they did it wrong, right? And I think a lot of parents are scared to come into therapy. You know, it's easier to just bring their child in. But pulling them in and having them feel supported and yet you may be challenged a little bit or given some tools and resources. But I think parents can often be, understandably so, defensive and scared and feel judged. And, you know, they often think that we believe everything in front of us, right? It's like, okay, everyone has their perspective. It's not that we're just completely like, okay, blank slate, writing everything down that everybody sure. says. But it is true that often there are things that do need to be confronted. And so I think it's a delicate balance, but I'm a huge believer in involving, because I work with a lot of kids too, is parents. I really believe in collaboration. So how does that tend to go? Do you do groups with the families, and how does that tend to go?
You know, we're working toward that. So again, Lido Wellness, we opened our doors. We took our first patient on April 25th of 2018. So we really are envisioning moving forward and being able to provide a service like a lot of, you know, some of the bigger and you know, kind of more foundational programs, which is a family weekend. So over time, we really want to develop a curriculum and a program in which whichever, you know, parents are whichever patients are participating, that, you know, one weekend a month that their parents, their loved ones, their, you know, partners can come in and really just get a better understanding of what might be happening,
right,
to provide resources and education. Currently, what we're doing is we provide weekly and or biweekly sessions for any patient that's coming into our program. And that is for our partial, you know, patients, but also for our intensive outpatient. And just to distinguish between the two, intensive outpatient is 3 hours a day. It can start out at 5 days a week, but it can also go down to 3 days a week. So it's, you know, 15 hours down to 9 hours per week. So it's very different. Mm-hmm. And typically what we would need to see as indicators of a readiness of intensive outpatient is some of the symptomatology to lessen, not fully go away, of course, but to just kind of lessen in the level of impairment, and also to see some of the resources start to grow, right? So we've had, you know, people in which they've participated in our partial program and then over a course of time been able to step down. We call it, you know, a step down into intensive outpatient. But either one of those, we really like to encourage family members to participate. And so
in the individual sessions, is that mm-hmm. what you're saying? Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, like, so right now I've got on my caseload, several, you know, patients in which I don't work with them individually. And we really, again, have a lot of intention behind that, where we really want people to have an individual provider that's just theirs, right? That doesn't have any of the potential for bias or any other information from that collateral, you know, system. Mm-hmm. And then we have a separate person who facilitates some of the family work. And by family work, that could be with a mom and dad. It can be, you know, sometimes we'll do kind of separate sessions if mom and dad are no longer together. Sometimes I'm doing couple sessions. So having a family member, a spouse or a loved one, you know, come in, even if they're not married, right? But if this is an important figure in their life and most certainly knows a lot about their presentation and their symptomatology, I want to know from that person. Like, I want right. to hear from them, because like you were saying earlier, often it's sometimes out of the awareness of the person we're actually treating, and it's the loved ones mm-hmm. that have, you know, really, you know, borne witness to what's been happening mm-hmm. and seen, you know, gosh, like, you know, before when you dealt with this stressor, it resulted in this, but now it's starting to look a little bit different.
Right.
So we want, you know, that those individuals to come in, because not only does it provide a tremendous amount of support, but it also gives them the resources too, you
right.
know,
right.
their resources are going to look very different as a loved one rather than the person receiving the direct care.
That's great, because I think, as you know, the average listener doesn't understand, but it's really important to have a therapeutic alliance where you feel safe and protected and understood and have good rapport. And so it's understandable that if I'm, let's say, seeing you and I feel like you're supposed to be my person and you understand me, and then all of a sudden you're trying to facilitate, well, this is my dad's point of view, but my dad and I have fought our whole lives. I mean, it gets, as a therapist, right, it gets into a very tricky category. And I think in private practice, you don't really have that luxury of pulling in another person all the time, unless you're like in a group practice or something like that. And I think patients get overwhelmed with this therapist and that therapist. And so I think we're always trying to navigate how to make that work most appropriately. But it is important that you have a place where you feel understood and heard, and yet that you're not living in a bubble, right? Your pathology, your difficulty, your joys and challenges exist within a dynamic of your family, your friends, your coworkers. Like I said before, it's a ripple effect.
Right.
And so I think a comprehensive treatment program has to look at all of those factors, because they all affect us.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And we even, not that we have a hard set rule, but for those that are coming into our program and say they're local, right, they live right here in Laguna Beach or, you know, in an Orange County area, you know, sometimes people will have their own care providers, right? Sometimes maybe they have a psychiatrist that they've worked with for years, and that it's a really good and functional relationship, and it's working really well. But that something's, you know, maybe med resistant, or maybe there is kind of more of these like situational, familial, systemic issues that can't be met, you know, and treated like on a once a month or every other week therapy session. And so we tend to recommend, and again, it's not a hard rule, but when someone's coming into a program like ours, we like to give them the opportunity to really have kind of all hands on deck under one roof. Mm-hmm. So it's really clear. It's easy to navigate.
You guys can talk to each other and collaborate, right?
Yeah. And we really prioritize that. I mean, gosh, I don't know where I would be if it weren't for my team of people around me. We rely so heavily on one another. In fact, even just driving down, I was, you know, just unpacking the day, you know, with my program director, right? Like, we're in constant communication because that helps us treat people better, right?
Absolutely.
To know, you know, hey, this person had a really tough session and then you're going to be going in, you know, tomorrow in a family call. Like, you need to know what was happening, right? A little bit of what was shared, what they might be really sensitive about. And so we, you know, not only just during the day-to-day activities, but every week we set aside 2 hours every week, Thursdays, 1 to 3, it's our time. And we come together as a clinical team and just really decipher, you know, what's happening. And also to really speak about, you know, kind of the meaningful progress and or transition obstacles, right? Like, you know, we do a lot of times have people that are out of state. And so what are some things that we're already anticipating before they're getting on a plane to go home? You know, What are meetings like in their area? What are local therapists like? You know, sometimes we'll have patients that are coming from really rural areas. Mm-hmm. And so we want some extra support around helping them navigate the mental health in their local community and the support. Because, you know, really we try to prioritize as an entity and a center. We want this to be a person's last stop, right? Like, we want, whether they have had 5 treatment experiences or if this is their first, we don't want to be a revolving door, right? Mm-hmm. And from a business perspective, it doesn't make any sense, right? Mm-hmm. But from a mental health perspective, it makes perfect sense,
right?
Like, I tell my private practice patients all the time, I want you to get well. I love you dearly, but I want to reach a point in which I'm not seeing you as much.
right.
Because then I know I'm doing a good job and that they're doing the work in between our sessions.
Right, absolutely.
Right? And so we want people to come to our program for a very short period of time in their very, very big life and be able to get all of the tools and resources that are not going to cure whatever's happening, but are at least going to get them to a place in which when they're then back home, back in their environment, back being the wonderful, you know, family members and friends and coworkers that they are, that they don't ever have to kind of take such a hiatus from their life again.
That's important too, because it is a large hiatus. I mean, can you talk about the impact on people's jobs and things like that? I think that's one of the big reasons people don't want to go is I can't afford the time. I can't leave my job. I mean, obviously staying well and healthy and alive and living a life that's meaningful and fulfilling and well is, you know, to me more important than those things, but it's not so simple. Obviously, when you look at the hierarchy of needs and what we do have to provide for ourselves, how do you tackle that piece for people?
You know, it is a big piece. And, you know, one thing that we really value is transparency, right? So we like to tell people just based on, you know, upon, you know, maybe an intake screen or a call, what they might anticipate, right? And we, again, it's not a perfect science. We in no way, you know, can say, oh, from knowing a person through a 25-minute call, can we predict meaningfully how long they might need a program like ours? But we usually have a pretty rough idea, right? With that, then we can make recommendations on how they can navigate things like with regard to work. The good news is that once people are completed, say if they need a level of care, like a partial hospitalization, once they get to an intensive outpatient level of care, which is way less intensive, you know, 3 hours a day as opposed to 6 hours a day, we really like to help support people if at all possible and if it's meaningful to do so on what it might look like to start kind of reintroducing and reorienting back into the work environment or back into family environment. So, you know, sometimes, especially, you know, with today, you know, more and more people are able to work and do some type
remotely,
of meaningful work remotely.
Right.
So we encourage that, you know, and we have a beautiful space in which we at times even, you know, if somebody is say having an issue with kind of adhering to like a structure, right, that they, you know, they wake up and they're just, you know, really overwhelmed with, you know, the day and what's to, you know, come and what's being asked of them. even if they're not part of, like, say, our 6-hour program, they are more than welcome to come and work in kind of the common areas. Like, hey, if you just need a quiet place to study or to, you know, engage in some remote work, you can do that here. And then you also have your access to clinicians that if, you know, you start to get overburdened or, you know, be draggled with, you know, a lot of things going on, then you can just pull somebody aside and say, hey, like, how do I reboot this? Right. So we've actually, at least, you know, from my perspective, now I'm not, again, on the perspective of having to take the time off, but it does seem like our program is really conducive for a working person and even a full-time working person, where, you know, they can apply at times for FMLA, they can apply for short-term disability if they have those accessible benefits through their employer. And people have been really successful with it. You know, we also work really hard to, you know, provide any supportive documentation. So, you know, between myself and some of our medical providers, you know, that also helps people, you know, kind of have that assurance, like, okay, I know also that I can have the required documentation to support this leave and that it's not going to be, you know, something that I'm going to have to face all on my own. You know, that there's a lot of conversation, you know, happening with that to make it as streamlined and as smooth as it possibly can be for something that could otherwise feel very disorienting, very, very scary.
Right. Yes, and I agree, because when people are in these programs, what I found is that they're in this environment. It's very safe. It's very supportive. They've been kind of plucked out of their lives in some regard, especially in the you know, more longer-term programs. And one of the big anxieties and stressors is how to integrate back into, quote-unquote, real life. Right, where I don't have a therapist at my disposal, where I don't have a supportive group members, where I have to deal with my chaotic ex-spouse and my kids in custody or whatever's going on, or my job or my boss. So I think what you're saying is extremely important, is that you want them to be successful, right? So we're trying to help them get the tools to move through the program and then integrate back into life, because real life doesn't look like it does when you're in the program.
Right, right. And that's where, you know, coming from a foundation of experience that I worked in primary residential programming. So that was, you know, where people lived on site, you know, they had access to care 24 hours a day. We had awake staff, right? So even in the middle of the night, if somebody was in distress, there was always somebody there. And to me, while that was very important, very fruitful work, I have found that people are really doing so much work, and more is being asked of them when they're having to do things on an outpatient basis, when they're having, like you said, to reintegrate into regular living. And even if that regular living for some of these folks might be navigating going grocery shopping, right? Where that was really hard before. And in residential, you don't have to do that because there's a chef.
Right. Right.
So, you know, being able to do some of those things, you know, and providing support amongst that. And that's where, like, that check-in hour is so important. And you know, sometimes I wish, you know, I didn't have scheduling constraints, in which I would actually love to do that group more and more, because sometimes that can actually be the biggest fruits of our labor, which is, gosh, like, you had a lot of barriers and or stressors that you were coming up against from that 3 o'clock on hour. And then what were some ways that you did okay, right? What were some ways that you demonstrated some growth? And then what were some ways that you're also demonstrating some ongoing struggle, right? And how do we, you know, kind of help navigate that so that it doesn't continue to be a barrier to the point where then you go home and then, you know, things get, you know,
right,
so backwards.
I can see that. That makes sense. And I think that is the whole goal, is to get them back into their lives, right? In a way that, you're right, you're not going to have a chef. You're not going to have those things. You're going to have to navigate all those daily challenges, which can be a lot, even in a normal, quote unquote, day, right? Let alone a day that's filled with something extra with regard to work or demands. As we're wrapping up, if you're just tuning in, my name is Dr. Kim Sage. This is a show that explores mental health topics and therapy. Tonight we're talking with Dr. Leslie Tate-Gould. She is the Executive Director at Lido Wellness Center. We've been talking about really intensive mental health treatment and what her center provides, and just in general. Can you give us, in our last minute or so, before we just wrap up, what do you think are the, you know, few most important things people should know about if they're considering a program like yours? I mean, what do they need to know? What's really important to know in terms of what these programs can offer? How do you decipher? There are so many programs out there. What do you see are the key hallmark important points for choosing a program?
Oh, gosh, I might need a whole extra hour
I'm
for
sorry.
That question.
I know, it's a big question. But, I mean, you know, just like bullet point it for us. What do you think, you know, three or four really important things?
You know, one thing that I think is really important, and that we really prioritize at Lido Wellness, is the importance of a community and a group. So we do a lot of services that are in a group orientation, and that's with intention because, you know, I've had, you know, at times people say, well, gosh, I went to individual therapy for 7 years, but all of my problems, like, were still there.
That's not good. Yes.
You know, and again, that's not, you know, speaking to one versus the other, but I think really, really wonderful things can happen in a group. And so if there's something that, you know, if somebody's on the fence of like, gosh, can this be something meaningful that I can do? I think, you know, treatment, you know, it's there for a reason, right? And it's there when things reach such a level of acuity and or unmanageability in which, you know, we really do need to actually take the pause. We need to take the hiatus. Because if we don't, our bodies and or the environment, mental stressors and how we're working within them, they're going to force our hand. So I think one is that there can be such power in taking this time, setting it aside and really prioritizing both yourself and also noticing that that also is going to have a profound effect on all of those around you, right? My hope, you know, in having talks like this and, you know, most certainly in the work that I do is to advocate on the need that we have of, you know, really prioritizing ourselves and the work that we're doing, as if we're not able to be honorable to our own needs, then all is lost, right? Then we're not able to be productive workers. We're not able to be productive parents. We're not able to be productive loved ones, right? And so if we're having mental health illness and some of those symptoms that are going to, you know, create barriers and or some of the impacts of trauma, if we're not able to prioritize this, then we're not able to engage in life to its fullest. And it's tough because at times, I've known a lot of people who are profoundly wise and incredible human beings, but that they're just kind of getting by, you know? And so sometimes I feel like a program like ours, it really invigorates and invites kind of a bigger examination, kind of a shakeup of what's been happening or what hasn't been happening, so that people can kind of be reoriented. And what I mean by that is they can kind of start to question their thought process, that they can start to get more engaged in their nervous systems. You know, unfortunately, like with the pressures of, you know, high productivity, really, really putting high demands, especially in this local community of both our young people and of parents, right? That it really forces people to kind of disengage from what actually is happening, from what's happening in their bodies, from what their bodies are telling them, right? From their gut instincts. And so because our program really specializes in trauma and mood disturbance, and kind of the way in which we go about that is from kind of a very integrated, holistic perspective, we're really teaching people and kind of reintegrating and reinforming them about the power of their body. And that they have a tremendous amount of untapped capacity, that maybe, you know, beforehand, or maybe these symptoms really created barriers to accessing. So, you know, I hate to use the word destigmatize because it kind of gets thrown around loosely in a similar fashion as like self-care, right?
Right.
Like those things kind of get thrown around. But the people that are working within our program, both clinically and those participating in our program, I mean, these are profoundly incredible humans, right? They are knowledgeable, they're inquisitive, they're curious, they're creative, right? These are not sick people.
Right.
And so I think it's really about being able to kind of look in our own mirrors at times and say, gosh, like maybe I could be doing something different in my life. You know, maybe something's getting in the way, or maybe there's barriers that I might not even be conscious of. And a program like ours can really kind of like open some of those doors and can really just kind of open up some of the familiarity and normalize, right? Like, hey, this is really normal to struggle with. Like, hey, there's four other people in your group that have the same struggle.
Right.
And like, let's hear from them. And like, let's kind of get through this together. Because we're social creatures, mm-hmm. right? And we really need that. So gosh, I could talk on this for another hour, like I said, but I won't.
Well, your passion comes through. I can hear it. And we are really grateful that you joined us tonight. I think it's such an important topic, and you guys are a great resource. Can you tell our guests where they can reach you? Just give us your contact information if they're interested in making a connection.
Yes. Let me pull it up because I have so many phone numbers, and I don't want to confuse it with the wrong one.
No worries.
So, and we are located, just for those of you listening, we are located in the Lido Village over in Newport Beach. So we've got two locations, one in which we do a lot of our group practices, and then within walking distance, we also do all of our individual and or family couples sessions. It's a gorgeous location. It's just got great energy, and it's a great local resource. So our best contact line, this would go directly to our admissions coordinator and director, and his name is Colin Whedon, and he's a fantastic human being. So our direct line for that is 949-633-2821.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Leslie Tate Gould, for joining us tonight. She's the executive director at the Lido Wellness Center. And we hope tonight, if you found something about this program interesting and you want to learn more, please reach out to her or me or someone in the mental health field if you need help. Just as a reminder, if you are in need of any sort of, help in your life and you're really, really struggling and you are feeling like you're not sure if you want to be here anymore, I do want to just provide for our listeners the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number, which is 1-800-273-TALK. That's TALK, 1-800-273-TALK. Thanks again for listening to the Dr. Kim Sage Show. As you guys know, this show airs live Monday evenings at 8 p.m. on KX 93.5, your local independent radio. And, hope you have a beautiful evening, and I will look forward to seeing you next week.
I took my love, took it down. I climbed a mountain and I turned around. And I saw my reflection in snow-covered hills till the landslide brought me down. Oh, mirror in the sky, what is love? Can the child within my heart rise above? Can I sail through the changing ocean tide? Seasons of my life. Mm-hmm. Well, I've been afraid of changing, 'cause I've built my life around you, but time made you both. Landslide.